as global problems, because truly at this point we have many environmental problems that are global. And once we recognize that, also recognizing that if we're going to solve them, we've got to adopt a kind of global strategy, one in which all nations of the world will cooperate. We're talking this morning with Senator Al Gore. He has written a book that's just recently come out, laying out some of his thinking, both about the problems that we face and how we ought to come to grips with them. His book is entitled Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit. Houghton Mifflin is the publisher. And I thought I'd just read you a few lines out of the book that will get us started and will let you know where Senator Gore is coming from. At one point, he writes this: "Modern industrial civilization, as presently organized, is colliding violently with our planet's ecological system. The ferocity of its assault on the Earth is breathtaking, and the horrific consequences are occurring so quickly as to defy our capacity to recognize them, comprehend their global implications, and organize an appropriate and timely response." He goes on to write, "I have come to believe that we must take bold and unequivocal action. We must make the rescue of the environment the central organizing principle for civilization. Whether we realize it or not, we are now engaged in an epic battle to right the balance of our Earth, and the tide of this battle will turn only when the majority of people in the world become sufficiently aroused by a shared sense of urgent danger to join in an all-out effort." The book also lays out something that he calls a global Marshall Plan to deal with the environment, and we will talk about that. And as we talk with Senator Gore, you certainly should feel free to call in if you have questions or comments. Our telephone number here locally here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line so that anywhere around Illinois or over in Indiana or any of the other little bits of states where the signal travels, if you would like to call in, please feel free to use the toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Al Gore is a Democrat from Tennessee. He represents that state in the Senate. He's been in the Senate since 1984. Before that, served in the House of Representatives, and before that, worked as a journalist. And we welcome him to the program. Senator, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, David. I'm glad to join you.
I think that your book has full of some very powerful and, in some cases, elegant prose. So I think you did very well with it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I think it seems that you're approaching the issue kind of on three levels or in three steps. Perhaps the first being the fact that individuals have to be convinced that we do face serious problems, that we ought to take them seriously, and we ought to do something about it. That from there, then, individuals have to convince their government that it's important, and then governments have to work together to get at these problems. So maybe we could talk about each one of those things, starting really with the first one, because I think that certainly there will be many people who will agree with you in the level of concern that you voice in your book. There may be others who would say they're not certain whether the problems are as serious. There may be even some people who'd say they're not even worried at all. How do you persuade people that this is an important struggle that we all have to be involved in?
Well, first, I agree with your analysis of three levels, and it does have to begin with personal commitment. And Earth in the Balance is a very personal book, and I believe that part of the healing process our civilization has to go through involves reintegrating the personal with the political. We have adopted this scientific worldview for the last few centuries that objectifies everything in the world, and yet we have to understand things within the context of our own individual lives. And I personally believe that at bottom this ecological crisis is a spiritual crisis involving our relationship, each of us, to the earth itself and to the physical world. And I find that individuals all over this country and all over the world really are re-examining some of these issues, and they're seeing signs of change in their own personal lives, and it's hard to look at the thermometer and see that the last 2 years were the hottest 2 years in recorded history and really find much significance in that, because in an individual's lifetime there's a normal fluctuation, you know, and not just in the weather, but in events generally. How do you interpret change? But more and more people are seeing the pattern of very big change in the environment, in our civilization, in our culture. And I think people feel in their bones that we have to make some major changes. At least that's what I'm hearing.
Mm. I'm interested in having you talk some more about this idea of environmentalism of the spirit that you referred to in the book, something that you would hope that we could cultivate in people. What exactly does that mean, environmentalism of spirit?
Well, I think that our civilization faces a crisis of meaning. I think people wonder whether their lives have as much meaning as they would like. We see these posters that are intended to be funny that say, "He who dies with the most toys wins." And modern culture emphasizes consumption and activity out in the world without much attention to what's really most important in life. And I think that people find it a little odd that they don't, in some cases, know their neighbors. They stay in their automobiles and go from the car to the front door, and the kind of community involvement that we used to have seems to be missing in so many communities around the country. I think people find it odd that we as a nation are content to borrow $1 billion a day and not worry about the impact on our children. It's as if we're not connected to either the communities in which we live or the generations that will follow us. And I think that in order to heal the ecological crisis, we have to look at the lack of connection between our individual lives and the larger web of relationships from family to community to nation to what is now a global civilization. And in an even more basic way, I think that the rhythms of modern civilization have led to a kind of alienation from the earth itself, whereas people used to be close to the land, and during the agricultural era were in tune with the seasons. Now there's an artificial quality to the industrial civilization in which we live that I think has created a spiritual crisis. And I think, well, what I mean by the phrase environmentalism of the spirit is an effort to rebuild that sense of connection to the natural world.
Mm-hmm. We're certainly at a time now when perhaps the single issue that's on people's minds is the economy and economic conditions, and there are certainly a lot of people that are facing very difficult times. And I think if we went out and did a survey, we went out on the street and asked people if they supported protection of the environment, of course they'll say yes. The difficulty is that when it gets to look like it's going to cost them something, then they're going to start thinking about it again. So that sort of makes you wonder, well, are they really telling you the truth when they say they're concerned about the environment? Or is the depth of their concern that shallow? Or is it that they simply feel that they have to place other concerns first? And, you know, what do we do about that?
Well, I think some people still believe the outdated assumption that we have to choose between a healthy environment and a healthy economy. And if you believe that is a choice that we have to make, then in times of recession you feel like you have to relegate environmental stewardship to second place. But more and more people are finding that's a false choice. It's ironic, for example, that those nations with the worst economies always seem to have the most devastated environments. Hmm. And those companies that choose a commitment to environmental protection so often see their profits and productivity go up. In fact, waste in the form of pollution is economic waste, and the careful attention necessary to eliminate environmental impact, harmful environmental impacts, ends up producing greater efficiency in every industrial operation or business. And that's incidentally why Japan has suddenly started imposing much tougher environmental standards on its corporations than those embodied in U.S. law. They're finding there's an economic payoff, not just in the form of greater efficiency, but also in a better chance to exploit these new worldwide markets for the environmentally efficient products and processes. So it's not a choice we have to make, happily. We by choosing to have a cleaner environment and to minimize the impact on the global environment, we will also find economic advantages.
We're talking this morning with Senator Al Gore. He represents the state of Tennessee in the U.S. Senate. We're talking about environmental policy, and you can read about some of his thinking if you take a look at his recently published book, Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit. And, of course, if you'd like to speak with him, you can call in. The number here, 333-WILL or 9455. You match up the letters with the numbers. That's what you get. There's also a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers to talk with, so let's do that. We'll start first on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Senator Gore.
Yes.
I know this may sound like a blurb on a book jacket, but I've already read your book twice.
Oh, great.
My local librarian was kind enough to give it to me. And so I immediately went to the credits, being a ghostwriter, and found that your wife had read every draft.
Yeah.
And that your sources checked out very well.
Well, thank you.
And so, you know, I really commend you for the depth of the book and the breadth also. Because,
well, okay.
You know, the echo clash that we are in really needs a balanced perspective, and I think you present that. A couple of things. I was particularly fascinated about the climatic history that you presented, such as the 1770s in Europe, and even back to the time of Leif Erikson and beyond that. Locally, the people probably will find that your book is a hard row to hoe, because you put a lot of information in it, and it's a most, you know, detailed book. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of working on the local level, the most citizens can be involved is environmentally, in, you know, composting and recycling and such as that. And at the present time, we haven't got a lot of things in line that make it work. We still have the 30-second commercials that tell us about doing all these good things, but then when you try to do them, you find the frustration level is pretty high. There's a lot of verbal environmentalists around who talk is cheap, and I basically have come up with a variation of Einstein's theory that E equals M4, that, you know, put your money, mind, and muscle where your mouth is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting phrase. Let me say, first of all, that I appreciate your kind words about the book. And indeed, I wrote every single word of it. I was a journalist for 7 years before I got into politics and got printer's ink into my veins. And
that happens.
It was a very satisfying experience to write the book. And the climate history chapter is one that interests a lot of people. But I wanted to respond directly to your comments about local environmental activism. I agree that we must have the parallel development of policies and programs as personal commitment increases. I was talking with David at the top of the show about how it has to start with the personal. But at the same time, as people become more involved, they have to find avenues for the productive use of that energy. It's so frustrating for some people who collect paper for recycling, for example, and then find out there's no program in the community that allows that paper to get to market. And so it just stacks up. Some communities have had that experience. And that's why I propose in the final third of the book a whole blueprint for solutions at the national and international level. I think that an interesting shift is taking place now. When a local environmental problem comes up, like the siting of a new landfill or something, people get very involved and make it the number one issue in the community.
But the NIMBY theory comes into play then.
Yeah, they feel their backyards are threatened.
Yeah.
But what's changing now is the definition of the word backyard. As people realize in larger numbers that the devastation of the global environment is having an impact on their own backyards, then we're beginning to see with some people the same intensity brought to these global environmental issues that you find in local landfill siting controversies. The fact that the air you're breathing right now and that I'm breathing, that David is breathing there in the studio, has 600% more chlorine atoms in each breath than it did 40 years ago. That's due just to chlorofluorocarbons, and it's true everywhere on Earth. It doesn't hurt human health directly, but it affects our backyards, and it affects human health indirectly because that's what burns the ozone layer and lets more ultraviolet B radiation in and damages the immune system and hurts the food chain. In eastern Canada, where I was 3 weeks ago, the people there have been warned not to let their children go outside this spring because of the potential new ozone hole above that area. That's hurting their backyards. And so the distance between the local and the global has suddenly contracted. And in order to protect our backyards and our children and future generations, we have to find ways to work together to stop the devastation of the global environment. And the good news is we can do it.
Well, I agree with you, but just a little example that last week our local volunteer recycling group borrowed a truck from a farmer. We had 3 tons that we could get onto his truck. We took it to a broker. We received $19 for 3 tons of paper and plastic. We paid the farmer for his gas, which was $10. We had $9 left, yet a local hauler had quoted $60 to haul it to the same place, and yet if we'd put it in a local landfill, which is not in Illinois, it happens to be in Indiana, it would have cost $45 to get rid of it. So the economic balance, you know, really has to be brought into play here. And are you proposing, or do you know of any groups legislatively? I know here in Illinois we have a marketing task force that has been formed, and these things are being looked into. But on the national level, what is being done to give help to recyclables as well as
well, material? Last year I introduced the National Recyclable Commodities Act to provide stability in the markets for recyclable goods and commodities, and this legislation is making a little progress at the committee level, and we need a national recycling policy. I might add, though, that we also need to look at policies that subsidize the use of so-called virgin materials. In the case of paper, the taxpayers are now subsidizing the clear-cutting of our national forests in order to make the price of virgin paper artificially lower, and that hurts the market for recycled paper. So you have to look at all aspects of it, and we're attempting to do that.
But also recyclable paper breaks down over a period of uses.
Well, not necessarily.
So you have to have a virgin element involved.
Well, it depends on the technology. And so some virgin paper, depending on how they make it, breaks down even faster. If they use some of these chlorinated substances that they have used in recent decades. So, and they're making great advances in the technology of recycling. And Earth in the Balance, incidentally, is printed on 100% recycled paper, and it's holding up pretty well.
I have to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me because I have a couple of other people that I want to include. Our guest this morning is Senator Al Gore. He is a Democrat, represents the state of Tennessee in the U.S. Senate, and we're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Earth in the Balance, which has recently come out. Houghton Mifflin is the publisher. Let's go on to someone else, and line one is next.
Hello, Senator Gore.
Hi.
Hi, it's a real pleasure to be talking to you.
Thank you.
I wanted to come back a little bit to the economics, and that is I'm an economist here at the University of Illinois, and I'm particularly interested in your comments about poorer nations and the amount of pollution they produce.
Yeah.
And I think the important element, especially looking thinking about Eastern Europe, is the fact that when you have a big brother mandates and all thing approach to economies, you tend to get very inefficient and wasteful results. And I wonder to what degree you're concerned that similar approaches to environmental issues will also produce inefficiency and poor results, in the sense that having to set up the market forces and market discipline will be critical to any successful use of a program that's going to improve the environment. And attached with that, I'm particularly interested in this idea of smog rights and property rights that you see going on. And do you support that type of approach?
Well, first of all, I agree totally that political and economic freedom are prerequisites for saving the Earth's environment. Where political and economic freedom are suppressed, the environment is the most devastated. Where individuals have political and economic freedom, they naturally prefer to live with clean air and clean water and a nice, pristine environment. Look at Eastern Europe as the clearest example, or Russia or Ukraine. These areas have the worst environmental problems anywhere in the world. Now, I would say, however, that our current approach to free market economics features some oddities in our measuring systems that lead to environmental harm where it should not take place. The way gross national product is calculated, for example, if you're a developing country with 1 million acres of rainforest and you cut it all down this year, when you make up your gross national product for the year, you will include the income from the sale of all those logs, and you'll subtract the depreciation on the chainsaws for the wear and tear and the trucks for taking the logs to the market. But nowhere do you reflect the fact that the rainforest is now gone. Our system of national accounts, which was set up about 50 years ago in the end of the colonial era, was based on the implicit assumption that natural resources are limitless and that we don't have to really worry about anything except labor and capital. Mm-hmm. And that assumption is simply wrong. Now, the same thing could be said by the for the way we calculate productivity, for example. The oil spill in Prince William Sound had a net positive effect on the United States' productivity, because the damage to natural resources is not calculated in our current system of measures. So at this historic juncture, when free market economics and political democracy have won the war of ideas with communism, we have an obligation to, yes, expand political and economic freedom around the world, but we have a heavy obligation to address the shortcomings in the way we currently apply these systems. And I have a whole chapter in Earth in the Balance on economics, which analyzes the changes that I think need to be made in the way we measure the full costs of the choices we make.
I find it a fascinating concept, and I just I'm hoping you could just address, and I'll let you go, is how this ties in with property rights, and that is, can you attach to the property rights, if I own a forest, I have to deal with the long-term effects of what happens to that land and to smog. If I create smog, it's my smog, and I have to deal with its negative effects as well as the benefit of having produced whatever I produce.
I think that there are some values which are impossible to define or account for solely within the concept of individual property rights. I know of the theorists who try to come up with conceptual frameworks for assigning private property rights to the air and to the water in the rivers and lakes, and I don't think it's practical. I think that part of our problem is that we try to define everything in terms of rights and nothing in terms of responsibilities. This is a philosophical view that comes out of the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, which really began about 350 years ago. On the same day that the American Revolution began, July 4, 1776, Wealth of Nations was published, and the patent for the steam engine was granted the same day. And this era, which has caused so much good, has also led us into a way of thinking that now needs to be examined a little bit. Don't we have responsibilities as well as rights? And where the atmosphere of the entire world is concerned, I don't think that we can define it solely in terms of individual property rights. It's a common good.
I wonder if I could ask you a question sort of related to that, that also relates to this case that the Supreme Court is about to hear, and perhaps people will be familiar with this. That is this case of this man, and I don't recall exactly.
Lucas where, in South Carolina.
That's right, in South Carolina, the man who had the oceanfront property, and then the government told him he couldn't build on it. And he is making the argument that the under the provisions of the Fifth Amendment, which says government can't take your land without compensation, that that's a taking. And some people feel that if the Supreme Court finds in his favor, this would call into question a very, very wide range of environmental law that we have in this country. And apparently there are some number of conservative legal thinkers in the country who would be very happy to see that happen and believe that a lot of that is a lot of that law is unconstitutional. What do you think the outcome of that might be, and would that in fact have a dramatic effect on attempts to pass and enforce environmental regulation?
Oh, I think that it would have a dramatic effect, and the outcome should be a ruling against Mr. Lucas, in my opinion, although I'm not sure that will be the outcome, because the Supreme Court has been packed the last 12 years with a majority of extremely conservative judges that don't represent the mainstream viewpoints in our country on several important questions. But let's just look at the principle involved in that case. Let's say that you bought a sports car, a Maserati or a Porsche or some very fast sports car, and then the government in Illinois decided to put a speed limit on the highways for the first time of 65 miles per hour. Well, when you invested your money in a car that's capable of going 140 miles an hour, you did it on the assumption that you would be able to go full speed, and now all of a sudden, because of a new state law, you can go only half the speed that you had intended. Should the state government have to pay you money because they've taken away your ability to use that sports car in the way you had anticipated? Maybe it's an extreme example, but in this case, this man bought sand dunes right on the beach. And after Hurricane Hugo, the state of South Carolina passed a new law saying it's not fair to all the other property owners in that area for people to destroy the sand dunes, which represent the only natural barrier to the kind of extensive beach erosion that's becoming commonplace all over our coast as sea level increases. And he says, well, now, wait a minute. When I bought these sand dunes, it was okay to build on them. Now you're telling me that for environmental reasons I can't build on them. It's going to hurt the other property owners. you've got to pay me money for the damage you've done to me by passing this law. And I think it's an absurd theory. I understand how he feels, and I understand the wrong that he believes has been done to him. But the common good in protecting the sand dunes and the other property owners who will be damaged if the beach breaks through those dunes is I think, more important.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Toll-free line is next. Hello.
Hello, Senator. Sir, I heard you on Larry King, and I heard you on Tom Snyder. I heard you on Milton Rosenberg's show in Chicago.
Well, I'm getting my message through to you, then.
Yes, yes, you are. But on one of those shows, I heard you make what I call an attempt to minimize the environmental damage in the Persian Gulf by comparing it with Pinatubo. Now, it's documented in at least two editions of the Scientific American that the George Bush administration made a desperate or deliberate attempt to obscure, like the clouds of smoke that covered the area, any monitoring or any report or any data coming from there. And I heard you give a specific figure. Now, I think you may have done this. I suspected at the time your approach was designed to deflect your voting for that Carl Rowan called a wretched war, in which I'm sure you were able to come up with this guy's name in South Carolina, Lucas. So you're quite sensitive, sir. I'm sure you read Tom Wicker's column in the New York Times shortly after the end of that operation.
Mm.
And
yes, I did.
And how critical he was of that.
Sure.
Now, sir, you're in Washington. Your family was in Washington before, I believe. Aren't you a relative of a senator that preceded you?
Yes.
And certainly you knew men like, unprincipled men like George Bush, who has no core principles, and Dick Cheney. You gave them a blank check to go in there and do this horrible environmental damage and human damage. Now, sir, would please respond to that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. First of all, I think you misunderstood the comment that you heard earlier. I was not attempting to minimize the environmental damage in the Persian Gulf. The figure I quoted was designed to give an accurate picture of what the environmental damage is we're doing every single day worldwide. The figure that I used is that all of the oil well fires in Kuwait put together, 600 of them, on the worst day, put an amount of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere that equal less than 1% of what we put into the world's atmosphere every single day. Now, that's a comparison that is not in any way intended to minimize the environmental damage done by all those oil well fires. It's intended to give you a yardstick by which to measure the less dramatic, the less recognized, constant environmental damage that we're doing worldwide every single day. No, that was an ecological catastrophe there. But in terms of your comments about the war itself, I disagreed with a lot of the decisions George Bush made in that war, especially the decision to not finish it and not to enforce the terms of the ceasefire and to allow Saddam Hussein to murder the Kurds and the Shiites in the south and to leave Saddam Hussein in power there. But in terms of responsibility for the environmental damage, maybe you have a different recollection than I do, but it's pretty clear that the United States didn't set those oil wells on fire. Saddam Hussein set them on fire. And he also intentionally released the huge oil spill into the Persian Gulf as a tactic for trying to foul the water intake valves in Saudi Arabia. Now, if you take a ruthless dictator who is willing to purposely inflict that kind of horrible environmental damage and sit back and let that person acquire an arsenal of nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles, then what kind of damage to human beings and the environment is he going to do with that kind of arsenal? I think that we were right in pushing him out of Kuwait. I think that George Bush lost his nerve in the final days of the war, but I think it was the correct decision to back him out of Kuwait. I don't think we ever should have gotten into the situation in the first place, because I don't think we should have coddled Saddam Hussein during the months and weeks leading up to his invasion the way President Bush did.
We just have about 10 minutes left. I have another caller standing by, and I want to move on again. Our guest is Senator Al Gore. He's a Democrat, represents the state of Tennessee in the U.S. Senate, and we're talking about the environment and what we ought to be doing to maintain it, both on a national level and also on a global scale. And if you're interested in reading some of his thoughts on this topic, you can look at his book, Earth in the Balance, which is published by Houghton Mifflin and has recently come out. Of course, if you'd like to call in here, too, you can do that. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Our next caller here is line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I like what I've heard so far, but I wanted to raise a little different issue here. Concerning coal and oil-fired power plants,
right?
I've read somewhere that the carcinogens and other soot that is spewed forth from these power plants probably contributes to about over 70,000 premature deaths around the world, or maybe it's just the United States. And if you could contrast that to perhaps the nuclear power industry, which I don't think has that type of record of people dying either directly or even indirectly. And also, is it true that they have a technology for nuclear power where they can take the toxic waste and mix it with sand and thereby make it into a rather inert material?
Mm. I don't think they yet have a technology for disposing of nuclear waste that is satisfactory, nor do they have a location for disposing of it that is satisfactory. It all depends upon what level of risk we are willing to accept for future generations. I don't rule out the possibility that research will provide us both an acceptable form of waste disposal and a new generation of passively safe, standardized reactors that have a level of risk that's acceptable to the American people. But the current generation of nuclear reactors, in my opinion, represents a technological dead end. The utility industry has come to the same conclusion, and as a result, there have been no new orders for reactors in almost 15 years, and that's an economic decision as much as a safety decision. I think we ought to emphasize the conservation and efficiency, the use of microprocessors in every engine and furnace, and new design approaches, new sources of renewable energy, and continue research to see whether or not these problems with nuclear power might be solved in the future.
Do you consider the current coal and oil generators to be acceptable in their safety?
Well, no, I don't. No, I certainly don't. And your point that we have underreacted to the environmental consequences of burning oil and coal is a point I certainly in the process, we are changing the amount of heat from the sun that is trapped in the Earth's atmosphere, and that in turn is changing the pattern of global climate. Now, I don't think it's an accident that 8 of the 10 hottest years in recorded history have been in the last 12 years, or that this was the hottest winter in recorded history, the winter we've just been through. So, yes, I agree with you that the environmental consequences of fossil fuels must be reexamined.
Okay. I just wanted to get off the phone and make one little last comment about your idea of spiritual environmentalism or whatever, and just applaud you and your wife's efforts against pornography. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
We're here at the point where we're getting sort of close to the end, and I have a couple of other people that I want to try to include. But you know, at the beginning of the program, I mentioned the fact that part of the book outlined what you called the Global Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
And you really already talked about one of the points, and that is to try and design a new way of thinking about productivity that also reflects economic cost.
Right.
And obviously we can't discuss all of this in great depth, but I wonder if you might want to talk about one or two of the most important points, additional points, that are part of this global strategy that you talk about.
Yes, I'd love to. I think the effort to save the Earth's environment must become the central organizing principle for the post-Cold War world. In the last 50 years, the organizing principle for Western democracies has been the defeat of communism, so that the Interstate Highway Bill passed as the Defense Interstate Highway Bill, and federal aid to education passed in direct response to the Russians launching Sputnik. In the same way, an effort to make the saving of the Earth's environment the new central organizing principle in the aftermath of communism's collapse will make it possible to gain support for widely disparate efforts that come together in a coherent purpose, saving the Earth's environment. For example, a strategic goal of stabilizing world population by making birth control more available, safe birth control more available on a voluntary basis, by lifting child survival rates so that parents in these developing countries have more confidence that their children will survive and thus have smaller family sizes, as research shows will occur, and lifting the level of literacy and education so that women are empowered to take part in those choices. I think we also need a strategic global effort, I call it the Strategic Environment Initiative, to accelerate the development of new technologies that allow economic progress without environmental destruction. Technologies like better forms of solar energy, more efficient techniques for conservation. We know what a lot of these technologies are, but we need to accelerate their development and then make them available to these countries that are desperately trying to achieve some measure of economic progress and don't really want to repeat the mistakes that have been made in industrial countries by fouling their environment. I think we need a whole new generation of treaties and covenants like the ones that are being negotiated for the Earth Summit this June in Brazil, and I think we need a new effort at global environmental education as well. Those are just a few of the strategic goals that I would make a part of a global Marshall Plan funded by Japanese and European wealth and U.S. leadership.
Very good. Let's talk with someone else. Line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. A lot of spinning thoughts here. The conversation's really interesting. I had a specific question that sort of dovetails into what you were just talking about in terms of productivity versus environmental cost, and it has a lot to do with automobiles in the United States, which I think are one of our biggest polluting sources, and CAFE standards, and wanted to know what the senator felt about recent, what I think are movements toward cases involving the General Motors Corporation and small car advocates in terms of safety,
yeah,
and whether or not in the book there's any projections about safety versus energy efficiency. Read an interesting article in Popular Science yesterday about the Japanese being one of the most energy-efficient societies on the planet right now, and you can talk a lot about social costs, but just make that as a note. You know, I mean, I'm wondering where our models are supposed to come from. You know, you've used the phrase the aftermath of the communist collapse several times today, and I think that I don't think the capitalistic system has proven that it can handle a lot of these loads any better than any other system can right now. And I guess I'll point out the General Motors Corporation as something to question returning to that. And so, you know, where is the model, and what can you tell me about where we are with CAFE right now in terms of corporate average fuel economy, and where you think we need to be? And I appreciate the conversation.
Well, I think we need to push those standards aggressively. We're arguing with Detroit about whether or not they can make a car fleet that gets 25 miles per gallon. And Honda just announced a mid-size car, not a small car, but a mid-size car that gets 55 miles per gallon with no new technology. I went to check how in the world did they do it. It turns out to be very simple. They just put microprocessors in the fuel line and the air line, and they come up with a consistently leaner mix just before the fuel goes into the carburetor. We've known for years you could mix more air with gasoline and get more bang per BTU, but now with the new information technologies, we're able to be a little more precise about how those mixtures take place. I mean, it's ridiculous to accept at face value the arguments from Detroit that we're going to have carnage on the highways and economic disaster if we get to 25 miles per gallon. It's just absurd. And if I can use that as a metaphor, David, this new technology for mixing air and gasoline more efficiently, mm-hmm. In terms of our public policy, the challenge is not to mix gasoline with air, but to mix money with intelligence. And we've got to have policies that are a little bit higher on intelligence and leaner on money so that we can get on with the task of solving these problems. You know, people know instinctively that if we just get our act together, we can solve this problem fairly swiftly, but we've got to have leadership. We've got to have the kind of personal commitment that I think people are now bringing to this task of saving the environment, especially young people, and then get on with the task.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. I wish we could continue. I'm sure we could fill more time profitably, but that's what we have, and I appreciate very much you giving us the time this morning.
Oh, I enjoyed being with you, David. Thank you so much.
And for those people who would like to read more of Al Gore's thoughts on the environmental issues we've been talking about this morning, I would suggest you take a look at his book. It is entitled Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin, and it's just recently come out. Certainly you could find it at a library or a bookstore near you.